This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, our 11 for 11 series of conversations with big thinkers continues with psychologist Bruce Levine on how to put some bite back into our demoralized democracy. He says politicians are out of step and voters are pacified. We'll hear his critique. And also, a New York Magazine writer defends what many have called the scourge of contemporary culture, narcissistic pop music. But we begin with the defense of another much maligned substance, salt. We've always been told that too much salt in our diets cause hypertension, water weight gain, and dehydration. But a meta-analysis of several studies published earlier this month in the American Journal of Hypertension casts some doubt on the hazards of sodium. Now, here to tell us why salt may not be as bad for us as we've been told is Michael Moyer. He's editor for Scientific American. The magazine's current issue is featuring the story, "It's Time to End the War on Salt." Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So this look, seven studies on salt and hypertension prompted the article. Tell us about those results.
Well, what they found is that there were no strong evidence that cutting salt intake reduces the risk for heart attacks, stroke, or death in people with normal or high blood pressure. And it's really just the latest in a long line of studies that have really failed to show a strong correlation between cutting salt and lowering blood pressure.
But is it in opposition to earlier studies?
What you find is that there's a lot of noise in this data and not a lot of signal. Some people would argue that we cannot cut salt enough in order to show an effect, and that there's just no way you can live in the world today and have the amount of salt that you would need to really get down to a low blood pressure. Other people note that there are some people in the population who seem to be especially sensitive to salt, and for them, you see a lot of blood pressure reduction. For the majority of the people in the population, though, you don't see that real strong connection between salt and blood pressure. And so when you do these large clinical trials, you run into problems because you get all this random noise that's messing up your data.
We hear a lot about the high sodium content in snacks and prepared foods, especially sodium and salt. Are we talking about the same thing?
Sodium and salt are used interchangeably. When you start to talk about the numbers, you have to be careful about what you're talking about. The average American consumes about 3.4 grams of sodium or 8.5 grams of salt a day. So, you know, salt is sodium chloride. Sodium is half of what salt is. Another interesting study that came out just last week, I believe, looked at the ratio of sodium and potassium that people had in their diets. Potassium is found in large amounts in fresh fruits and vegetables. Bananas famously have a lot of potassium. And they found that the higher the ratio of potassium to sodium that people had, the healthier they were. So it could be just one of these things, as you mentioned, that the processed foods that we eat could be causing a lot of these results and not enough fresh vegetables. That's one of the difficulties of doing nutrition research is, of course, people aren't just consuming salt, they're consuming food.
So, Michael, where did salt get such a bad name? We've been told for decades, I think, to cut back on salt intake. Where did those recommendations come from?
It's a very interesting story. Back in the 70s, a researcher named Lewis Dahl had claimed what he had was unequivocal evidence that salt causes hypertension, and that he did the study by feeding rats the equivalent of 500 grams of sodium a day. And as I just said, today the average American only consumes 3.4 grams of sodium a day. So this is a factor of 100 more than anyone is really getting in their diet. From that, he concluded that salt is causing hypertension. There was also another study done in the 80s called the InterSalt Study, and it looked at salt consumption around the world in different populations, and also looked at blood pressure of the people in those populations. And they found in a lot of cases that the people who had the most salt intake had the highest blood pressure. Now, when they went back and did a closer look at a lot of those populations, they found that within populations, you didn't see the signal, right? So the Japanese, for instance, had a lot of salt in their diet and high blood pressure. But then when you go and look at the Japanese population and see the people who have not a lot of salt in the Japanese population versus a high amount of salt in the Japanese population, you don't see that correlation with blood pressure. Mm. So, you know, it's been shaky from the get-go.
We're talking about new evidence that casts doubt on the validity of the war against salt. A meta-analysis of 7 different studies published this month in the American Journal of Hypertension found that the link between sodium intake and hypertension may be completely overstated or even non-existent. European journals found similar results. Michael Moyer is an editor for Scientific American magazine. Now, that magazine reported on the study's finding as well as other publications. And you, Michael, spoke with Professor of Nutrition Marion Nessel after the article was published. Now, she took some issue with the findings of this analysis. What'd she say?
That's right. I had a chance to speak with her after this, and we have a transcript, an edited transcript of that Q&A up on our website for those who want more information about it. But she said that, okay, we don't have very strong clinical evidence that there's a strong connection between salt and hypertension because it's very, very difficult to do these studies. We can't find people who don't eat enough salt to kind of have that low baseline that we're looking for. But we do know that there is a subset of the population that is very sensitive to salt. She says that doctors, when you they have a patient with high blood pressure, one of the first things they all recommend doing is cutting down the amount of salt. And she also says that all of the committees, you know, the dietary guideline committees and the like, when these experts get together and talk about it, they all say Americans would be healthier if we had less salt. So even though the studies are very difficult to do, that's not to say that there isn't an effect, at least in some people. And so in that case, it's worth doing these public health measures to lower the amount of salt in processed foods, for
instance. Michael, we do have to wrap, but it's a tricky aspect of all this seems to be that it is unclear whether or not salt is the cause of hypertension or is an indicator of an overall unhealthy lifestyle. Now, why do you think this article and this issue is so important?
Well, I think that people only have so much that they can, they only have so much of a bandwidth for what they can intake in terms of their public health messages. And I think we need to focus on the ones that we're most sure of. And that's really just eat food, eat good food, try and cut back on the processed stuff. And I think that if we made that case to the American public, then we'd be much healthier as a society.
Well, we over here at Word of Mouth are very happy for the vindication of salt. We're all big fans, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Moyer, editor for Scientific American magazine. Now, there is a link to the article, It's Time to End the War on Salt, and much more about the new findings about one of my favorite condiments at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, has the growth of self-celebratory sentiments in popular music ruined American culture? One writer chimes in to defend the influences of Gaga, Kesha, and maybe even Rebecca Black. That's when Word of Mouth returns on NHPR. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. No, this is not a nightmare. It's music from Rebecca Black's much-anticipated follow-up to Friday. That song and the YouTube video, produced with $4,000 of seed money from Black's mother, went hyper-viral. Friday, which was named the worst song of all time, was a vanity release by the production company Arc Music Factory. That such a company exists supports what media critics, mental health experts, and public radio guests have labeled an epidemic of narcissism. A recent study of self-referential pop music made the media circuit. Other studies suggest that the cult of self-esteem has made for entitled kids and poor workers. Magazine articles declare the me, me, me generation absorbed by their Facebook posts and ruled by conceit. Nisu Ababa challenges the idea that pop culture is breeding narcissism. And if it is, he says, perhaps it's not such a bad thing. His article, We Must Be Superstars, in defense of pop, and maybe narcissism too, is in the latest New York Magazine. Nisu, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Many of our listeners may have heard about this recent study of pop music lyrics between 1980-2007. Now, this was a team of psychologists said that there's been a very steep increase in self-loving sentiment in the songs that kids today just can't seem to get enough of. Tell us a little about the study and how it was received.
Well, it's by a team of research psychologists who I think have been generally tracking this rise of narcissism across the culture. And they studied the lyrics of pop songs across that period. And, their results said that there had been a rise in ego and in hostility toward others that had gone on over this period, which a lot of people seem to receive with a sort of glibness, as if they had sort of felt that all along, and music had gone terrible over that period.
Well, that's what you point to. There's a sort of gleeful targeting of narcissistic youth, maybe rather than sympathy.
Yeah, I mean, these psychologists obviously are interested in our mental health, so they're worried that this is actually adversely affecting people's lives and making them less able to deal with the world. But for most people, I think there's just a sense that this is annoying and people are entitled and selfish and think a lot of themselves.
How about you, Nisu? How about how you receive these findings? What do you think of the changes in pop music and how they reflect upon our culture?
Well, yeah, I was mostly interested in the as it reflects on pop music itself, because I feel like there are much bigger changes there than anything having to do with narcissism. Like the actual role of pop music over that period of time has changed really drastically. It used to have a specific purpose, which was often sort of this blockbuster ballad purpose. It was meant to be the music that everyone heard. And now that's sort of shrunk in a weird way. It now has a much more specific purpose that most of the music on the charts tends to be stuff that's for social environments. You know, it's club songs are now the things at the top of the charts, things for dancing and feeling fabulous.
But why is it that certain artists, like, say, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, they get targeted for exacerbating narcissism while other pop artists don't? I mean, we don't see Beyoncé being vilified by psychologists.
She's not the type of person that would come up as an example a lot. I think when people report on this kind of thing, there's a tendency to slip back and forth between talking about narcissism and just thinking of pop as vapid. And somebody like Beyoncé fits maybe our model of a classic R&B singer in a way that that doesn't attract that criticism, whereas stuff that's really pop and people think of as vapid, like Katy Perry, will get a lot more static for this.
But pop has never been acknowledged for its great depth, has it? I mean, isn't there something useful about vapid pop music?
It's a question of what we want to consider vapid. A lot of what I think is useful about pop right now is that because it's very socially focused, it's not abstracted or interested in sort of high arty things. But that leaves it to really tackle a lot of these basic social things about dancing and courtship and the way people relate to each other. And if you consider that to be superficial or vapid, or things like ego and beauty, then it might seem vapid. But those are actually things that we all deal with a lot. And pop can often, in its not always artful way, have a lot to say or sort of act out about those topics.
Nisu Ababa is a pop music writer for New York Magazine, and he's making a defense of pop music. We posted a link to his article, We Must Be Superstars. It's in the most recent issue of New York Magazine. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, maybe, Nisu, the danger here is that people don't really have the variety in their music diet. It's not like, you know, when I was growing up, I had to listen to what was on the radio. That was all that was coming out, unless I was buying my own records. Doesn't happen so much anymore. Is that the problem, you know, if Kesha is the only thing that they listen to in their headset?
I suppose there are some people who really identify with her, and, you know, that works fine. I think, you know, a lot of why pop has developed a really narrow purpose is that we do have access to all this different music, so people can vary dramatically in what they want to listen to in their sort of free or home time. And some of the only times when we all have to listen to the same things are when we're dancing or partying. And so the music on the charts tends to really be pointed at that.
Although I would admit, in your article, you even admit to being a little aged out of this millennials, those accused of being rampant narcissists. What do you see as the change in tone in pop music from the Gen X generation and today?
I can only sort of mostly speak for myself on this. I grew up with listening to a lot of sort of miserable and depressed and self-deprecating indie rock records. And I think that does create a tinge of jealousy for the ego and confidence and entitlement that's, allegedly coming from these from these pop records. I mean, they definitely have a sense of drive to them that I wasn't necessarily picking up when I was younger, and it does feel like there's a certain boldness and willingness to go after things that, you know, I'll see in people younger than me that would have been considered a little bit embarrassing or gauche when I was that age.
So you're not shaking your head and saying, "Oh, young people today, they're just a lost generation."
No, not at all. I think that they're quite effective at getting a lot of things. I envy that a little bit.
Yeah, maybe we're both a little jealous of the Celebration of Me music not really available to us. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us and for your very contrarian view of what a lot of people are calling the cult of narcissism. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dangerous. If you're one of us, then roll with us, because we make the hipsters fall in love when we got our hot pants on and up. And yes, of course we does. We run in this town just like a club. And no, you don't want to mess with us. Got Jesus on my necklace. Got that glitter on my eyes. Stockings ripped all up.
Nisua Bubba is pop critic at New York Magazine. We do have a link to his article and more reflections on the culture of narcissism at wordofmouthradio.org. How about you? Are you a proud narcissist or simply a closeted pop music lover? Looking in the control room, I can answer that question for at least one person. Our director today, Rebecca Lavoie, seems to know all the words to this song, We Are Who We Are, by Kesha. We're pretty clear on what that says about her self-worth. Send us a tweet and let us know where yours ranks. And later in the show, we're going to be talking with a psychologist and rabble-rouser about the deflated self-worth of American voters. That's coming up in our 11 for 11 series. But first, overblown self-worth isn't the only problem with contemporary music. In this story by producer Jamie Katsoufis, a musician finds himself stymied when his growing popularity calls for a transition from his lone wolf stylings to performing for an audience.
This is Chico Man, a.k.a. Marcos Garcia, a 36-year-old Brooklyn-based musician who likes to blend Latin funk and Afrobeat with vintage drum machines to create a new musical genre he likes to call Afro Freestyle. His records are unique and funky, and since the release of his first album, Manifest Tone Volume 1, his fan base has grown steadily. But when the time came for Garcia to take his one-man band on tour, he found himself with an interesting problem.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, when I started recording as Chico Man, I had no intention of playing it live. I didn't even really think about that, you know, because it was electronic. It wasn't until Kindred Spirits wanted to release the first album. They're like, so, what's the band? I was like, I don't know. I have no, like, I didn't, all of a sudden it was just like, wake up call, you know, how are you going to do this live?
For his first few tours, he opted for the simple solution to his one-man band conundrum. He hired some musicians. The band's size peaked in 2009 when Chico Man was touring as a five-member ensemble. Garcia, two female vocalists, a DJ, and a percussionist. For his current tour, however, Chico Man has decided to go it alone and do all the music making himself. On any given night of the tour, Garcia stands behind a wall of laptops and MIDI controllers, weaving his way through his repertoire and playing the role of conductor and orchestra simultaneously.
I'm basically controlling all the parameters of everything that's happening. And it's like being the master puppeteer, you know. I got a couple puppets I'm working with, you know. And I'm using, like, you know, I'm using my feet and my hands, like, my voice, every part of me is being employed in the show.
The music sounds great, as always, but the live experience is drastically different. And visually, some fans may be a bit confused by what they are looking at, a fact that Garcia is well aware of.
People associate what I'm doing now with DJing, and no disrespect to DJs, but like what I do is, you know, I'm working with my own music and interpreting it and improvising with it and playing keyboards and singing and, you know, it's quite different than what a DJ does, I think.
Looking forward, electronic musicians like Chico Man will continue to create great music. And performing electronic music will continue to be an ongoing experiment that forces musicians and fans alike to ask the question, when it comes to recording versus the live performance, which is the work of art and which is the reproduction? This sample for KQED, I'm Jamie Katsoulis.
And Word of Mouth returns with the next installment of our 11 for 11 series. Today we're talking about political passivity among American voters. That's after the headlines from the BBC. This is NHPR. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
10 ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more?
And now our 11 for 11 series of conversations about innovative approaches and ways to consider the biggest issues of our time continues. Today, re-energizing America's demoralized democracy with psychologist, blogger, and author Bruce Levine. People the world over were moved by the swells of protesters who whipped up democratic fervor during the Arab Spring. While here in the U.S., people express despair over our political process. Polls show that politicians are out of step with the will of citizens on issues like the Wall Street bailout, healthcare reform, and the current deadlock over raising the debt ceiling. A Washington Post ABC News poll said that 72% of Americans want to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans, yet several Republican lawmakers have pledged to avoid any compromise that would raise taxes. If it were up to Bruce Levine, that 72% would be marching in the streets. But his read is that American voters feel broken and impotent and have been on a long slide from active to passive citizenry in a slump of poor self-worth. He is a radical progressive with a clear call to get up, stand up. That's the title of his book from Chelsea Green Publishing. The subtitle is a mouthful, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. And he joins us from WXVU in Cincinnati. Bruce, great to have you on the show.
Great to be on your show, Virginia.
You describe our current democracy as demoralized, as broken. You know, citizens are despairing. They're beaten down. Why those terms? Where did you come up with them?
Well, I see a politically pacified America. Not everyone, of course, but overall, when I take a look at the American public and how much they oppose in terms of governmental corporate policy out there, how they oppose the Wall Street bailouts, issue after issue on major issues, okay, big money, big power issues, where there's huge opposition and there's very little resistance, especially compared to recent other contemporary societies, the resistance that we see, for example, in the Arab world, and also, too, compared to the resistance in American history, where there were other periods of senseless wars and loss of liberties and loss of economic and social justice.
How did we get to this place of being broken and beaten down?
Well, a couple of things there. Lawrence Goodwin, journalist, and he's a historian, wrote a lot about solidarity, but probably most famous among historians for writing about the populist uprising in the 1880s, 1890s, which was really an agrarian revolt. It was a revolt by farmers against the, quote, moneyed elite of that time, which was the railroads, the banks, the grain elevator operators. And what he talked about was very interesting for me as a psychologist, that what he thought were the building blocks of democratic movements were two things. One was, he called a population having individual self-respect, and having a collective self-confidence. Individual self-respect, meaning people had a sense of self-worth, a sense that they should be not pushed around regardless of what their how much money they had or what their academic rank was. A lot of these farmers had no schooling or couple of grades of education, but they felt like they were worthy of having some power. They believed in genuine democracy, and also this idea of collective self-confidence just simply means to achieve a sense that they could win, that they could actually succeed in toppling the ruling elite of that era. And one of the points of a get-up stand-up is that we've lost a lot of that individual self-respect, and we've lost a lot of this confidence that we could actually overcome this ruling elite of our society, this corporatocracy, which is what I call it.
Let's pick that apart, this idea of losing self-respect and self-confidence as individuals. How did that wear away?
Well, one of the concepts that I talk about is liberation psychology and how important that really is now become for American society. If you take a look at social scientists around the world, whether they're in Africa or South America or Central America, they have understood for quite a while that a subjugated society, a colonized society, when they become externally oppressed for too long, they develop an internal oppression, which means that they develop a kind of defeatism, a demoralization. And that's one of the reasons why Bob Marley is so respected, so revered by many people, because he was sort of the poet laureate of oppressed people around the world and how to liberate themselves. And so he talked about this mental slavery that gets created. One of the problems in the United States is that we don't have a kind of a Mubarak, kind of a greedy personified character in his family, or even a Gaddafi kind of person. We don't have one of those kinds of tyrannies here. We have this thing that I call this corporatocracy, which is really a partnership between these too-big-to-fail corporations, these outrageously wealthy people like the Koch brothers and the Waltons, and also the corporate collaborating politicians. And this is what represents the true government of our society. And people equally feel a kind of powerlessness to do anything to affect change in their life, because this is kind of a totalitarian tyranny that rules them. But it's not so personified as it is in these other dictatorships.
Oftentimes, progressive people talk about, you know, democracy as a game kind of rigged by the elites. And this is one of the things you're describing. But one of the things I liked a lot about your book is that you don't present a kind of mastermind conspiracy by the corporate state to keep people down.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really all they care about is money and control. And when you have people at the top who are organizing a culture and organizing institutions based solely on how much money it makes for them, a lot of weird things happen. And so you have this kind of ascendancy of, for example, television. My guess is at the very beginning, they did not realize how pacifying a force television would be. It just seemed like a great place to advertise and to make money that way. And did the corporate elite in the beginning conspire, can figure out how, if we could get everybody watching in America television, which we do here just about as much as or more than anybody in the world, is that a great way we're going to pacify them? I don't think they thought that far ahead. It just sort of happened that way.
Today's 11 for 11 conversation is about re-energizing what I guess calls a demoralized democracy. Bruce Levine is a psychologist, blogger, and author of Get Up, Stand Up. And to that, we're going to maybe add rabble rouser. His book paints a picture of American democracy as broken and people angry about a government that does not respond to their needs, and how we suffer from a kind of battered people's syndrome as a result. You've introduced so many things, and I'd like to start to get into some of them. Well, first of all, this whole idea of elites versus afflicted people is simplistic view, and you break down how America is routinely divided. You know, we're often called liberals or conservatives or moderates, but you have another kind of division for that. Could you describe this idea of the afflicted and the comfortable anti-authoritarians?
One of the things that are interesting for me is how we who are populist, people who believe actually in government of, by, and for the people, are divided and conquered. And that is really historically the way the elite has always stayed in control. So there's a lot of ways they do that, obviously racially, ethnically. But one of the more intriguing ways for me is this, how we do it to ourselves in terms of the comfortable populace versus the afflicted. And I don't use that term comfortable anti-authoritarians pejoratively, like people used to call the bourgeois and the limousine liberals. I mean, the reality is that there are certain Americans who actually believe in genuine democracy, but they're more comfortable. They may have a decent job where they're making okay money, or they're one of those few lucky Americans like yourself, Virginia, like myself, who have a platform, have a voice. When we have something to say, people actually are going to hear it, as opposed to most Americans, the overwhelming number of them. For them, it feels like no one really cares what they have to say. So there's this large group of Americans who I call the afflicted populist, afflicted anti-authoritarians, who the overwhelming majority of us who have either major money problems, or they have a completely meaningless job, they're socially isolated, or nobody really cares what they have to say, and they're in overwhelming pain. And I think one of the problems for people who are the more comfortable folks, professors, people in the media, is they want to believe that if only we could get through with them with the information, if only we could break through and give them all these truths, then certainly the truths will set them free. But the reality is when you're in this sort of overwhelmingly pained, afflicted state, truths don't necessarily set you free. And I know that from what I've been doing for 25 years as a clinical psychologist. Most people who are in abusive relationships where their husband is verbally, emotionally, physically battering them or financially exploiting them, they know what's going on. So the truth of that exploitation, that abuse, is not alone enough to set them free.
That is a conversation that I think comes up a lot in different circles. People say, oh, Americans are just lazy. They're ignorant. They're stupid. They don't take time to become informed. There is this kind of deep division between people that you say should be sharing their vision and collectivizing.
I think it's one of the great mistakes of left progressive people out there. Not all of them. I mean, a lot of folks get this. But there's this almost sometimes contempt for their fellow Americans, is they must be stupid. They're not voting, And that not only is, I believe, wrong, I think it creates enormous resentment for this huge group of afflicted populace. And by the way, the vast majority of Americans actually do believe in government of, by, for the people, as opposed to rule by a elite. Now, they may debate on terms of who exactly is the elite, but generally people actually do believe in democracy in America here. And I think that one of the things that I wanted to get across and get up, stand up, is to have a different psychological understanding of why a lot of people out there who are getting shafted are so passive.
Bruce, you were just talking about the afflicted anti-authoritarians. Now, is that the population that became the Tea Party?
I talk to people across the board politically, and one of the interesting things for me in doing that is how much they agree on, but they're polarized by the corporate press. They all oppose the Patriot Act. They all oppose the Wall Street bailout. They all oppose a lot of these kind of crazy drug wars that go on. So there's issue after issue where there's a huge opposition across the board. And generally, I think that it's important for folks on the left to realize that a lot of these people who were in the Tea Party, some of these folks, unfortunately, are racists and bigots. But there's a lot of these folks. If you take a look at how that Tea Party originally formed in 2008, early 2009, it was the major issue was this Wall Street bailout. They were enraged by that. And this was really an issue for left anti-authoritarians as well. People like Bernie Sanders voted against that. But somehow the Republican Party was able to engage the rage and to sort of co-opt them. And so more and more, the Tea Party is not so much about this Wall Street bailout. It's about other things. It's about busting unions and undocumented workers. And unfortunately, this is a major problem throughout American history, that there's a certain anger about corporatocracy type policies that gets co-opted by one of the major parties. In this case, it was the Republican Party.
So you're saying that the gulf between the Tea Party on the right and progressives on the left was engineered?
I'm saying that there are a lot of different people who are in this Tea Party and a lot of people who are disaffected. My point is that I think that there's a lot of blowhards in the Tea Party talking about like wanting to identify with the original Tea Partiers. The original Tea Parties took the acts of civil disobedience. They opposed certain issues and they were willing to put things on the line. And so I find that kind of amusing, that even in the movement that a lot of the American punditry considers the major outspoken political movement of our era, even that movement is really without a lot of guts and courage and certainly any kind of significant civil disobedience.
We're talking with Bruce Levine, a psychologist, blogger, and author of Get Up, Stand Up. We'll be back with more on the conversation that doesn't reserve criticism for right-leaning or left-leaning institutions, but is asking all citizens to consider what their participation is in our democracy. And we'll leave you with Bob Marley singing Get Up, Stand Up, also the title of his book.
You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light. We're going to stand up for.
We're back with Word of Mouth in an 11 for 11 conversation today about re-energizing what our guest calls a demoralized democracy. We're talking with Bruce Levine, a psychologist, blogger, and author of Get Up, Stand Up, which leads to what you are suggesting for re-energizing the electorate, taking some risks, civil disobedience. The term you use is disruption. So are you talking about anarchy?
Well, anarchy, again, is one of those words that the corporate America has tried to convince folks has to do with violence and has to do with chaos. And really, anarchism is really about a belief that you should have a government without hierarchy. So that's a whole other issue. But really, if you take a look at major democratic movements, and there have been many in American history, from our own initial American Revolution to the Underground Railroad, the abolitionist movement, to our great labor strikes in the 1930s and so forth, I think one of the things that happens is this idea that information alone is the key to creating greater democracy, whereas the reality is that that's only one aspect, to know how you're kind of getting shafted, to know how you're getting exploited. But what's also required are basic strategies and tactics, and also what's required really are guts, it's courage, it's determination, it's solidarity, these very old-fashioned virtues. No democratic movement ever is going to happen without those.
So what does a fair system look like to you, Bruce Levine?
Well, I kind of like democracy. I mean,
how do we get back there? Maybe that's the better question.
One of the things that we've been broken on is in terms of social isolation. And you can't have a democratic movements with people completely socially isolated. And unless you care about something outside your own consumer needs, unless you care about something that other people also care about, you're not going to connect socially. And make no mistake about it, for a lot of reasons, our culture and our society is creating more and more isolation. 25% of Americans don't have a single confidant in their life because of this car consumer culture that people move every 5 years to hold on to their job and so forth. And so that's one big area, recreating community so that you can create solidarity. Another area that's really important for me is the whole area of questioning authority. One of the cool things about America, when immigrants used to come over here, go back to Tom Paine, but other immigrants over the years, they were always impressed by this is a place that you could question authority, whatever the authority was, in government or in religion, wherever it was, that this was a place that was okay, and that you were allowed to not only question authority, but challenge illegitimate authority and resist it. One of the great ways to build strength and courage is to do exactly that, and we're not doing very much of that. We're doing less and less of that in America today.
You ask readers, in fact, if they really believe that the corporatocracy can be toppled. Do you think most Americans would say, yes, we can change this?
Well, that's another divide that we have, and I think that's a divide a lot of us have internally. It's a divide of hope. A lot of us have been conditioned to the idea that it's impossible to topple the ruling elite. And one of the things I think it's important to do is to take a look at American history, at other institutions that seemed like completely all-powerful that have disappeared. And so I talk about in Get Up, Stand Up, for example, about the institution of slavery in the 1850s and how Abraham Lincoln, who really was adamantly against the spread of slavery, sits down and analyzes the situation economically, and he goes, boy, this is not going to go away. I mean, the South has way too much to lose, and the North really doesn't have that much to gain, and he comes to the kind of analysis that we're not going to even be able to stop the spread of slavery and forget about the idea of abolishing it. Well, you know, he's probably one of our more critical thinking, intelligent presidents in American history, but he didn't think about everything. And he didn't think about the idea that maybe he could actually get elected in being a third party with a minority to vote. And that would so upset the South that they would secede. And some crazy people in South Carolina would do something dumb like fire on a federal fort, which was sort of the 9/11 of that era. And that would be enough to give a lot of people in the North the idea that, okay, well, let's go and invade them. Before you know it, and within 10 years, we have legally abolished slavery in America. And so there's a lot of other situations. When I was a kid growing up, the idea of the Soviet Union disappearing seemed like an absolute impossibility. If you take a look at a history, there are a lot of these so-called too big to fail giant entities in government and other institutions that are actually a lot more fragile than people think.
Well, what about those of us who are, you know, reading the newspapers or yelling back at the radio or shaking our fists or smiting our forehead because we feel like we are powerless. Nothing can be done. What do you suggest that can change that?
Well, I think one of the great areas that upsets me the most is the pacification of young people. And the good news is there's lots of us, the people in the mental health profession like myself, but there's over 3 million teachers, there's parents, there's grandparents, there's aunts, uncles, who are in contact with young people who are getting increasingly pacified by their school system here. The good news there is that I talk to rebellious teachers all the time out there who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. They are conducting a kind of a civil disobedience. They are trying to get these kids to care really about reading, to care about critical thinking. And I think one of the things that we could all do is support them and support each other in terms of caring about this next generation of folks feeling okay about questioning, challenging, and resisting illegitimate authority. Because without that kind of an educational system, you're not going to have democracy. It'll be all over. But that's something that we can all do about each day in a lot of different ways. What's happening in my own profession, what's happening in the schools, it could be depressing on the one hand, but it's also empowering in the sense that you don't have to wait for election day to get back our guts, get back in strength. There are democracy battlefields to be fought and won every day.
Well, Bruce Levine, we want to thank you so much. You've given us so much to chew on today.
Thank you, Virginia.
Psychologist, blogger, rabble-rouser, and author Bruce Levine. You can find more in his book, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite, including reviews and a link to his blog. We also welcome your thoughts on his critique of America's crumpled self-worth and political passivity. What do you think? Do we live in a broken democracy? Do you feel like you have and use your voice as a voter? Is it being heard? Are right and left being divided by a corporatocracy, the media? Or are those just easy targets? You can let us know on Facebook and on Twitter and on our website, where you can also find a number of the diverse perspectives and conversations we've had from our 11 for 11 series. That's all for the show today. Please do join us again tomorrow at noon for Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.